Live Line on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry, bringing you great savings on curtains and bedding. Available all year in store and online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Live Line. 51551, as always, and the worry goes on. For our troops in the for everyone in the Middle East, but obviously we have a connection with our troops who are there. 350. Lauren, good afternoon. Your son is in Camp Shamrock. He's in his early 20s. This is a second time out there, Lauren. Good afternoon. And this is very different, you're saying.
Yeah, it's completely different. Totally, like, not the same trip at all.
Okay. In what way?
I suppose the fear factor this time is amped up by 100. The fact that he can't do his job this time. Everything is different. Communication is different. Food is different. He was not in the bunker the last time so many times. It's 100% a completely different trip.
And is he in the bunker for much of the time?
Oh, yeah, most of the time. The other day, they were in there for 25 hours.
Wow.
Yeah, and then we get out then for a few hours and go back in, and it's long. It's not in there for 30 minutes or even 2 hours. It's ridiculous. Like, it's a long length of time with no beds, with no, you know, I suppose, light, air. Their Wi-Fi, the Wi-Fi tower got blown up last week, so they've no Wi-Fi, so they've no entertainment, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They're sitting in a bunker waiting, listening to bombs dropping around them.
And at one stage you were talking to him and you could hear the bombs in the background, but he didn't he didn't flinch.
Didn't flinch. He says to me, "That's war, ma'am. I'm used to it."
But it sounds it sounds like they're bored.
They are. Well, they are bored. It's the same thing day in and day out. They can't go on patrol. They can't do anything. They're sitting in a bunker. They can't protect the civilians because they're all gone. They don't even know if they're even there, if they're even alive. And this camp over the years have built up a massive rapport with the locals.
Yes, brilliant rapport. Yeah.
So they are genuinely worried about where are they? Are they okay? And they have no idea if they are, and they can't even go and check.
But as far as they're concerned, they're gone. The civilians are gone.
Well,
the Israelis told them to get out, didn't they? Didn't tell them where to go, but told them to get out.
Told them to get out. They didn't care where they went. They didn't care what they did to them.
Now, you might have heard, it's developing, I'm noticing, especially in the last 24 or 36 hours, commentary from various commentators saying, this emotion from families on the airwaves isn't helping anybody, and it is an army, and this is what they're trained for, and it's not helpful. Mammy's crying on the radio, whatever. How do you react to that, Lauren?
This isn't just mommy crying on the radio. We can see what's going on. Obviously, we would be maybe a little bit more worried. But if you were watching RT News last night, you would have seen the reporter say that the IDF have no intention of leaving. They have no intention of stopping. And they basically said to UNIFIL to leave. And then UNIFIL said that, you know, something on the lines of the whole mission is based on the premise that UNIFIL being there, that both sides are agreeing to this, that both sides are saying they'll hold a ceasefire, they won't cross the border, they'll do blah, 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 and Israel have not done any of that. They're firing over the border. The border might not really exist, so why in God's name are 10,000 soldiers there, when clearly the parties they're protecting don't want them there?
And you think their mandate... the other thing I'm hearing is, you know, it would damage the reputation of the Irish Army if we ran away with our tails between our legs.
But I'm not saying pull the Irish Army. I'm saying pull all 10,000 of them.
Pull the whole UNIFIL force out.
The whole UNIFIL. What are they doing there? You know, the Israelis are not respecting them. I was told when my son was leaving, don't worry, the IDF won't do anything. They won't go near the border. They won't do this. They won't cross. And they have done it. They have killed thousands of people. They don't care what they're doing. And now they're leaving us. No, we told you to move. So it makes me get a sense of when something happens to one of the members of UNIFIL and they get hurt or injured or killed, the IDF will say it's your own fault because we asked you to move. Hmm. And I know now the Hezbollah have said, oh, don't worry, we won't fire on the outpost. We'll, you know, we won't retaliate. They have the blood of Sean Rooney on their hands after what they did to those boys that night, and Shane Carney. They're not to be trusted either. So, like, if this was a US outpost, I can guarantee you a helicopter would have went in and pulled those boys out yesterday.
And this whole argument, you know, the reputation of the army, I'd rather be alive with my reputation than dead with a better reputation. Whatever that means.
This to me isn't the Irish Army. It's UNIFIL. They have meetings with Artanis there yesterday or today or this morning while they were nice and cosy in a nice warm office drinking their tea, talking about the 10,000 soldiers down and saying they're fine, they're grand. They're not. If you open their eyes and look, the IDF and Hezbollah and Hamas, none of them can be trusted. And our boys currently, for some reason, our outposts are being used as human shields. Our other boys are inside in Camp Shamrock on two meals a day. One is a ration pack, one is a hot meal that, I don't know, my 3-year-old probably wouldn't be able to eat it or wouldn't be able to fill it. You know, there's other things in, like the bunkers. Everyone's saying they're safe underground in their bunkers. Their bunkers are not underground, they're ground level. They're built for shrapnel.
This is a statement from the military press office or the Defence Forces press office. Update on situation in Lebanon. This is the latest we have. The Defence Forces can confirm that all Irish troops are accounted for and well.
Yeah, they have. Do you know that's copy and pasted for the last 5 days? Have you looked at the same post? They're literally copying and pasting the same thing. What happened last Wednesday was a load of tanks rolled up outside the Irish outpost and the families went ballistic. Would you blame the families going ballistic? Mm. And then we were told, don't worry, they'll go away.
Defence Forces headquarters extend their sincere gratitude to the families and friends of our personnel for your steadfast support throughout this deployment. The Defence Forces confirmed that Irish soldiers are getting 3 meals a day, a mixture of frozen and fresh, and rations have not been used yet. So they're getting 3 meals a day. And they're not on rations.
And they're not on ration packs. That's hilarious now, since my son sent me a picture of him last night with his ration pack. He wasn't the only one eating a ration pack.
Okay, here's another relative of someone in member of our Defence Force in the Lebanon with a different point of view.
Hi, Joe. Just a point on the families of our troops in the Lebanon. However upset they are, we should also consider the wishes and self-respect of those trained professional soldiers before publicly calling for their withdrawal. I'm a family member of a Jadotville and Middle Eastern veteran. As military families, perhaps we should be proud of and be sure of the wishes of our family members who've chosen to serve their country. As children, we lived in Israel and in Egypt in the 1960s and 1970s whilst my father served with the UN following the Six-Day War. My mother was that concerned family member. She was in her 20s with a baby and a toddler when my father was prisoner of war in Congo, and the Irish papers reported that he and his company were dead. We're coming from the same place, but I just wanted to advise families that the soldiers may well have to live with the fallout from a family member publicly calling for a withdrawal when it's not instigated by the serving soldier themselves. It's a complicated situation which has existed for my whole lifetime. It's difficult in such times to trust the judgment of the UN or our government officials, we'd know given Jadotville, but the soldier will have to live with any fallout for the remainder of their lives. This can affect the family too.
What do you think of that, Lauren? Basically saying we should stay quiet and let the decision be made by the soldiers out there and the hierarchy out there.
As my point was a while ago, that I don't think the boys in the office there with their warm, comfy chairs have any right to speak for the 10,000 soldiers on the line. But, Joe, I don't want to wake up tomorrow and be told something happened. And we were on the wrong side of history and we did nothing to stop it. Do you know what I mean? The IDF are not doing what they said they were going to do. They don't care. And what happens next week if we hear that one of these bunker buster bombs that they had and that killed the head of Hamas went through one of the UNIFIL camps. Mm-hmm. And what they're going to say is, it's your fault, we told you to move.
And that caller mentioned Jadaville and the Congo. Actually, you might be too young, Lauren, but the soldiers of the Jadaville, who held out for days against a much superior and better armed force, have never been acknowledged, because at the end they surrendered and the Irish Defence Forces saw that as a damage to our reputation, and they've never been properly acknowledged. And a lot of them went to their deaths campaigning to be properly acknowledged, because they were heroes to a man.
I know a lot of people say the boys go over to the Lebanon, they go over there to get a bit of money and all this kind of crap, right? Like, they provide a sense of security for all the people around that area. They provide medical aid to them if they want. They go visiting the orphanages.
Yeah, that's what I heard today. The Irish soldiers there would be able to help the locals, but you're telling me the locals are gone.
They're gone. They're gone. They're all their shops, like Mini Street, is just deserted. It's gone. The people that used to work in the camp and deliver sandwiches and had something to do with the camp are now gone.
And tell us about, just explain Mini Street to our listeners, because it is a fascinating.
So Mini Street is like the little shopping area outside the camp. It is made of, I think, shipping containers.
Yeah.
There's one where they get their coffee and their whatever, and then there's Super Value. There's one guy who has called his little shop Super Value.
Okay.
And they all have a great laugh with the locals. The lads seem to put on the local accent, like they'd know, fella's from Dublin, this fella's from Athlone, so we'd put on his accent and they'll slang words from there.
And some of them speak Irish, don't they?
They speak more Irish than me, I think.
Yeah, okay. Now that's gone. That atmosphere, gone. That street is effectively, everyone has fled.
They're all gone.
I know Jadaville soldiers got some class of honour in June 2017, but it took them nearly 60 years campaigning and a movie and three books and four radio documentaries and non-stop campaigning. Kevin MacDonald, Kevin, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
And thank you for your service. You're a retired commandant and you did 40 year period, and you were in the Lebanon, Israel, Chad, Western Sahara and Syria. What do you think of this, the families in particular saying there is no reason for us to be there anymore, the locals are gone, those who we helped, be it medically or just helped generally, they've been told to leave by the IDF, and if the IDF tell you to leave, I don't think you get into an argument with them. What do you think, Kevin, of these calls for the UNIFIL operation to be suspended?
Well, I can fully understand the mm-hmm. fears and concerns of any family member. I was there myself in 2006 with my family when the 2006 war started, and I could see the shells landing on Tir where they were. So I fully understand all the concerns of the families. And I fully acknowledge that it's completely wrong for the Israelis to rock up and build a temporary base right beside 6-52, which ironically, when the Israelis withdrew in 2000, they were urging UNIFIL to put a position exactly where 6-52 is, because it overlooks Israeli settlements. So it's somewhat ironic.
Protection,
possibly. So they were looking at it as what we'd say in the military is key terrain. So obviously when they moved in, they saw that as key terrain as well. And there is a few ways, I suppose, of looking at the reason that they're close. One is they may be thinking that because they're close, then Hezbollah won't target them directly. Mm-hmm. Another way of looking at it is by being there, they'll intimidate the Irish out of it. And then there'll be no eyes and ears for the international community as to what the IDF may or may not want to do in that particular area. So relocating the guys and girls out of 6-52 would be a matter for UNIFIL headquarters, in consultation with New York. But knowing from how UNIFIL and the UN operates in situations like that. I've been there in 1984, I was there in 1993 for a seven-day war. I was there in 1996 for a seven-day war. And then I was there with UNSO for a full 34-day war. So I know that force protection is paramount whenever the senior leadership is considering anything. And at the moment, their concern is real life support in terms of logistics, getting these guys and girls the equipment they need, whether it's diesel for the generators, whether it's water, or whether it's rations. Most of these locations, and remember, it's not just 6552. There is a number of other locations in Sector West and also in Sector East where there is the same level of kinetic activity in and around these positions. One thing I will say, and I was discussing it on another program this morning, is that north of Maroon Ras is a village right beside 6-52, and north of that is a large Hezbollah-dominated town called Bin Jabail, which had been a target in 2006. It may well be a target again. If that is the ultimate aim of the IDF, well, then the central activities will move quite a bit north of 6-52, which will put them in a much more safer position. But what the ultimate aim of the IDF is, well, that's they're only going to be able to make that decision themselves.
And what do you think of this argument? Oh, if we left now, it would do reputational damage and we would be seen as leaving with our tail between our legs.
No, I don't think so. And you know, this has happened in the past, both during that war in 2006, there was a number of positions. I know in UNSA we had four positions and two of them were damaged, and we relocated out the other two. So it's not as if it hasn't been done in the past, and I don't think there's an issue with reputational damage. I think that the issue that UNIFIL will be considering is, first of all, how secure are the troops in these positions? And as I said, it's not just Irish positions. There's Polish positions, there's Spanish positions.
But are we saving lives? That's our job. That's of a soldier. Are we saving lives?
Well, it's not just, as we say in the military, POC, protection of civilians. It's also been the eyes and ears of the international community as to what's going on both sides. Atrocities by Hezbollah in Israel.
But Kevin, do you think Hezbollah or IDF give a swing in what the both sides have killed journalists? Why would they care what the Irish army are observing and not observing?
But it's not, in my opinion, it's not what they care. It's what the international community gets to see and hear by the reporting that the Irish and the Spanish and the Netherlands and the Poles do. So,
but do you think either side would heed that at this stage?
I don't really think they would, but it's international opinion. It's not going to be the views of UNIFIL versus the actions of either Hezbollah or the IDF. It's going to be the international community's view of those actions and the strength they can bring to bear on what intentions either side have.
Okay, and I know you have a book coming out, haven't you, Kevin? In fairness, because
on Thursday, A Lifeless Ordinary. But for anyone that wants to understand what it's like to be under constant fire and having to deal with issues, things like death of colleagues and stuff like that, I deal a lot with that. A lot about that in the book. There's other stuff as well. There's mountaineering, there's archaeology.
Yeah, I know. I know about it through our mutual friend Owl, who contacted me about it a few days ago. So that's why I wanted to. I didn't know you were coming on, which is great. And it's great to hear. And again, thank you for your service. I want to go back to Lauren just for a sec. 51551 is our text number. Lauren, what's it like for you personally living through this? I think your son is very young. He's in his early 20s.
I've probably said Crino. It's the only way I can describe it as a constant feeling of dread. Like, we can't distract ourselves all day. Like, it's literally there all day. Do you know, if you're doing something, driving the car, it's in the back of your mind the whole time. This does not leave. And I know other parents, I've been onto them, that's the only, and husbands and wives and stuff.
this is the only way we can describe it. It's a constant feeling of dread that something is going to happen.
But Kevin, is this the most dangerous scenario? And you've been there around a long time. Is this not the most dangerous scenario Irish troops have ever been in? Now, I can go back to the Congo, read a lot about the Congo, and I remember standing in O'Connell Street when the bodies came home from the ambush, the Nyemba ambush, wasn't it, on the back of the big army?
Nyemba, yeah.
The big army truck. So I know that was extraordinarily dangerous. We were badly equipped, as we know, at that time. But is this not one of the most dangerous situations Irish troops have ever been in? And it seems that they are there, and I try and leaven my words and dilute them, but it seems that the purpose they were there for initially has dissipated.
As I said earlier, it's not just a single purpose such as POC. Mm. There is the fact that they are the eyes and ears of the international community, which is important. I have the utmost sympathy and concern for your other callers there. I've been in that position. I've seen bombs landing where my wife and kids were in the city of Tyre. So I understand what they were going through, and until my wife and kids eventually got evacuated, I had the exact same feeling that your guests there are expressing, sense of dread. So I completely get it.
But comparing and contrasting, is the situation different?
It's hard to say. It's definitely a very dangerous situation. I completely agree with that. Whether it's worse than 2006, I'm not there, and I know your guests are talking to their sons and their nephews, and they'll have a fairly good understanding of what's going on. But my understanding from talking to colleagues who are in close contact there as well is that, yes, it's extremely dangerous. There's a lot of kinetic activity going on. They don't think that there is a direct threat to the Irish, or indeed the other nationalities. There is the threat of being caught in crossfire, which happens in every single conflict.
But you're of the view that the people who make the decisions would not put our troops in unnecessary danger. We know that the soldier is the nature of the service. But they would not put them in unnecessary danger just to keep their reputation intact.
Oh no! When that post was built, the priority when the post was being built was risk, what we call risk mitigation measures. So the bunkers and the observation post were designed to withstand a lot of direct fire weapons. Mm-hmm. Unlike back in the early day when I was in Lebanon in 84 and 85, where there was no really such thing as effective bunkers. Nowadays, the force protection measures for the troops is of paramount. And linked to that is what the troops would be tasked to do is based on how they can be protected during those tasks. So the senior management would not decide to send a patrol into a village if they thought that the risk to the troops was of a certain level. So, numerous times a day, the operations in UNIFIL will be doing risk assessments on whether they can go A, B, or C, or whether they should do A, B, or C. So it's the force protection measures are a constant and indeed our own leadership here in Ireland, because they're in daily contact with UNIFIL as well.
Thanks, Kevin, and best of luck with the book. And Lauren, we'll keep in touch, and hopefully you will keep in touch with us, and hopefully you'll be reunited with your brilliant son. Yes, Lauren.
Can I just say something? I just want to say, if any of the Irish troops are listening, that we know you're not afraid. We're not doing this to embarrass you. You're doing a great job. I know you want to stay if the Red Cross asks you for help to help people around the place, but maybe they just can't see what we can see because they love their job, they love the duty, but we are so proud of all of you. You're doing so well.
Well put. Well put, Lauren, and look after yourself, and thinking of your son especially and all our troops. I want to go to Kevin Chiribo. He works with Premier Urgents Internationale based in Beirut. What's the situation out there, Kevin?
Hi, Joe. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, I'm based in Beirut at the moment, going south as well fairly often. Situation in Beirut is obviously very tense. The bombing is pretty regular. There are now no specific times of the day that are limited to the bombing. So it's quite regular, mostly focused on the south suburbs, but based on the caliber of bombs sometimes used by the IDF, we can feel it across the entire city. We also have drones. I don't know if you can hear it now. There's a drone above me right now, which fly low so that we can all hear the buzz of the drone's engines to keep us all on our toes at the moment.
And who's flying the drones, Kevin?
And who's flying the drones?
Yeah.
Well, our assumption is the IDF. I don't think there's anybody else here who has that kind of capacity.
And we've seen the images. They're shocking. The images since October 7th last year, almost without an hour's let up, have been absolutely shocking. What work does PUI do there, Kevin? You run clinics and hospitals, do you?
Yeah, I mean, we run across the country. We run about 25 clinics and 11 hospitals that we're in support in. We also do a lot of shelter work for the displaced and what we call protection work, which is essentially protection of women and children in precarious situations. Obviously, as you may have seen, the situation here is catastrophic in terms of the needs. They have absolutely exploded. 1.2 million people have been displaced. That's an equivalent of around 20% of the population in the whole country has been displaced. The population is about the same as in Ireland. So it's equivalent. Imagine that 20% of the population has been displaced in a matter of 2 weeks. And that's not to mention the Syrian refugees who have been here for now not 13 years, who are also being displaced secondarily as well. So the situation is catastrophic. In terms of the bombings, they are so prevalent. I think we're at about 8,500 airstrikes now in about 2 weeks. They're so prevalent that it is very, very hard for our humanitarian teams to operate on the field and for civilians to know where the safe zones are, because they are being issued evacuation orders by the IDF on a regular basis, which are, you know, new areas. So when they find safe areas, sometimes those safe areas become unsafe areas once again. So there's a lot of uncertainty amongst the civilians here as well.
The figures are just beyond belief at this stage. Every figure, every new figure every day seems to plumb the depths of hell in terms of people killed.
Well, Joe, let me give you an example as well, maybe something a bit more visual. We've been asked by the state here if we can afford them additional cadaver fridges because there are too many bodies that are piling up. They can't hold them in the morgues at the moment. So one of the requests coming into us is whether we can provide them with additional body fridges. So, yeah, the situation is really critical. The scale and the level of the violence we're seeing is absolutely shocking from a humanitarian perspective. And the health infrastructure is being impacted majorly as well, which obviously limits our ability to be able to attend to the needs of injured civilians.
And insofar as you can ever generalise, Kevin, are the population that's being bombarded at the minute, what's the dominant emotion? Is it fear? Is it anger? Is it resilience? Is it bafflement?
I think for now the predominant emotion is extreme fear. Because of the scale of the bombing and the uncertainty of which areas are safe and not safe. So even when you displace to new areas, you can't really be sure that those areas are going to stay safe for long. So I would say predominantly right now, fear is infused across the entire population, not just in the areas where people are being displaced, but across other parts of the country, as the bombing is also expanding into new areas that previously were seen as unlikely to be targeted.
Okay, it's a developing situation, but enough. Kevin, how long are you involved in it? You're obviously from Ireland. How long are you involved in this work?
In this work specifically as a humanitarian, about 7 years, but in Lebanon, 2 years specifically. Yeah, been in Beirut for about 2 years.
Okay, well, it's safety to you and your colleagues and above all the people of Lebanon and the people of Palestine and the people of Israel and it goes on and on and on at this stage, the amount of countries that are involved, either directly or indirectly. Kevin Charbrook, thank you so much, Kevin. Thank you so much.
I kind of regards. Nice to be on with you.
Thank you. Joe at RTE.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And Joe at RTE.ie. Bernie, good afternoon. I mentioned the Congo.
Oh God, can I remember it? Oh, very, yeah. Very well. Like yesterday, listening to this story, the lad should be brought home because there's no telling which way it's going to swing. There's no shame in them coming home. They can always go back when things calm down. If it ever calms down, as I'd be saying to myself here, who's going to write them children's life story when this is all finished? It's horrendous. Absolutely horrendous. And they're now bunkered up with these laser bombs and everything, Joe. You know yourself, yeah. PW. You can see right through it. They cut through the ground. The lads, if you've gone there, cut the ribbons with them. They should bring them home. No shame at all. But after what we went through, waiting to hear about my brother when he was in the Congo, mm-hmm. he would have been on patrol with that bunch of lads that were killed that night, only he had taken sick. Yeah. And he was taken to a clinic, so we got notification then he had something resembling malaria, so he had to stay there for a few days. But luckily enough, he came home, but the next we knew, we were out on the canal on the march of honour, and a guard of honour for all the lads that were killed that night.
Yeah,
they should be brought home, you know, it should be, because we had photographs and all up for a while ago, Joe, I don't know where they're gone to in the house. When I heard that girl talking about Jadaville, I said, oh, sweet Jesus, that brings back, you know, going back to that. As we were getting ready to go to a film that night, myself and my sister, and it was miserable freezing in 80s night, kind of, and Orson Welles was showing in some big film that was only started happening, I think it was Woodard and Heights or something, and we were going over to the Sun Drive, and everything stopped dead in the house. The phone call came to the woman's house next door. She was the only one with the phone on the road, and we had permission. She had permission to let us take the call that night from... Well, we got him eventually, but he was lucky, Joe. He came home.
And there was nine.
An awful lot of them didn't, because there were an awful lot of them lads were in that boxing group out of that year in the army. We had a photograph of them all in the stadium there in their trainers and all the rest of us.
But so you had out there, Bernie. Who was out there belonging to
my brother.
Oh, your brother, okay.
My brother, yeah, Liam.
And there was nine kids. We know there was nine soldiers killed and many wounded by the in the ambush.
Oh, God. Oh, yes.
And where was your brother? It was early, it was 1960, November 1960.
He was only, I think, 19 or 20, Joe, something around that region. Yeah, he was only a snippet of a thing. But loved the army, loved everything about it, thought he'd never get into it and all the rest of it.
Yeah, there's a lot of it.
An awful lot of sadness too, like to see, to know that they can, if they can get them out now, because I dread to think, hoping it won't happen, but.
And what about the whole, this argument now that's rising up, they'd be seen as running with their tails between their legs and it'd be
not
bad
at all.
There's no shame in
getting them lads out there, Joe. Why should they die for someone else's conflict, someone else's conflict, someone else's religion? Because that's what's happening. If you hadn't got all these religions, you'd have no wars, you know.
And when did you find out that your brother was safe? Again, this is the 1960s.
I can't remember rightly whether we ended up going to see the film or not. We all stayed in the house that night because Mum and Dad were in bits.
Of course,
after getting the news of him. At least he was safe. He was in the hospital in some clinic. Not well, but a fever of sorts. But, I think it was about a couple of hours later, someone called to the door to take the telegram to state that they had him. He was all right.
Okay, but in the meantime...
From the press office, yeah.
In the meantime, your parents thought the worst, didn't they, I presume?
Oh, Jesus, we thought he was gone, Joe. Uh-huh. We thought he was gone. As I say, like, only being a kid myself and all the... It just all the home got back to me there when that man mentioned Jadaville in the Congo. He was in Leopoldville in the hospital. Yeah. Not well. So they must have had to shift him there.
And when your brother came back, Bernie?
Yes?
Did he talk much? What was his name? Did he talk
no,
much?
No, Liam.
Liam. When Liam came back,
No, he never spoke about it, Joe.
Wow.
As a matter of fact, I could safely say, looking at him, he wasn't the same lad that went out there. But he never spoke about it.
He was only a boy. He was 19.
Him and another lad off the road.
Yeah.
Him and another lad off the road. Oh, God, I forget what his name was.
Okay.
Ryan was his name, I think. But they never, ever, ever opened up about it. Never.
And is he still with us?
So there was... No, I know. He went away on holiday with all the family there a couple of years ago, his first time after retirement, and God for not to be too morbid, but Joe put cap and a cloak on it. He died on the beach in Portugal. Took a massive heart attack.
Ah, God rest
you. You know, yeah, his first holiday with all the grandchildren, with all his grandchildren, but was a hard ticket. He was a great character. Yeah. He really was. And we used to call him the Gancho, Joe.
The what?
The Gancho.
What's the Gancho?
Yeah, when they played cowboys and Indians up in the hills in Walkinstown.
Right.
And of course, he was the head, but he was the head, and I was the Gancho, the big boy, you know.
Okay, yeah.
And lost half of his finger to his antics, climbing or something.
But
I'm not a bit of fear, not a bit of trouble.
So you, this talk now, the families are on the radio and they're being too emotional and they're undermining.
No, they're not being too emotional, Joe. It's natural reaction.
Yeah.
How can you say they're being emotional? They're right to be emotional. It's one way of keeping themselves together, and another thing is plenty of notification to know how the lads are doing.
Yeah.
It's another communication they could put out there.
Yeah,
let a phone line or something where all the people can go and speak to their loved ones, but I don't think being under the ground 23, 25 hours a day, they must be nearly tearing their hairs out, Joe.
Yeah,
hopefully. And so hot.
Yeah.
So hot and everything else in them countries.
Okay, stay with us, Bernie, for a sec. Is Donald Branning and Donald? Okay, I'll go to him after the break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Donald Branning unfortunately dropped out there, but Donald's mate, you'd not be remember Donald from the Brannigans, the family band with Geraldine, probably the best known of the three. And they were one of the first entertainment groups to go out to the Irish troops in the Lebanon way back in the early 70s. And Donald was making the point, it's not just the locals that look up to the Irish troops out there. It's the other soldiers as well who have a great reverence and a great respect and a great comradeship with the Irish troops out there, and how highly regarded they are. Patricia, to carers again. Patricia, and rightly so, you're caring for your 39-year-old daughter, and she's 40 in the next few months, 40 in January. What is your situation, Patricia?
Hi, Joe. Thanks for taking the call. I've been listening over the past few days, and I just said, your researcher actually called, and I said I'll speak to you because Tara will be 40 in January.
Okay.
And of the 40 years, last year we got carers allowance for 1 year, but this year we haven't carers allowance again, because of the means testing and the stringent, you know, means testing that they apply. So what had happened is my husband took an early retirement and had a small pension for until he got to 65.
Yeah.
So in the last year of his his interim pension, you could say, his tied over lump sum and his small pension were so low that we were deemed poor enough to get the carers allowance.
You got under the bar. Pension,
when he got his pension then from the ESP, we were then put over the threshold again.
And you lost the full carers allowance.
Yeah, full carers allowance, yeah. So, I mean, while we were glad to get it, I suppose, for that year, I just wanted to highlight the fact that really we are caring for both of us, for our daughter, for 40 years, supporting her to live her best life here in her home.
Mm.
And
out of those 40 years, only for 1 year or less you got the carers allowance, the means test of carers allowance.
Yeah, yeah.
And as one of our callers pointed out to you today, if you went for a job as a carer, let's say it is a job, except it's a full-time job, 24/7, If you went for a job, imagine being asked, oh, by the way, before we give you the job, and the maximum salary, by the way, is €248 a week for 168 hours. Before we think about giving you this, would you tell us how much your partner is earning? Is there anyone else in the house earning? Before we decide, what your wages are. It's based on what...
Well, also, Joe, I suppose the thing is that Anthony, my husband and myself, have worked all through that time. So I worked part-time and he worked full-time. And now we both work part-time and we are here on the opposite sides of, you know, so that we can be around for our daughter. So it's kind of, you know, it's nearly being kind of penalised for doing, you know, for working. Because we have five other children, so we had to work to, know, put them through school and college, et cetera, et cetera. But it just doesn't recognise... the fact that we are doing what we're doing. More so because our other children have kind of flown the coop. And so, you know, we have to choose now who goes where, who does what, because, you know, there isn't someone at home to be with my daughter. Look, we've a good life. I'm not kind of complaining because we kind of embrace every moment. Anyone who knows us will say that. But it's just a very... It's just not right, really, that someone is not recognised by the state because Tara is nearly 40. She is a citizen of the state, and so are we. So she is entitled to be able to do, you know, what she would like to be doing at nearly 40, and so are we. So, but we're not being recognised, you know, for that, for being individuals, really, as opposed to, we're a married couple in our 60s. She is a young lady in her heading for 40, and we're kind of interlinked and kind of not recognised as being in our own.
Okay, your line, unfortunately, is deteriorating. Patricia, briefly, like, has your daughter been, obviously children are dependent anyway, but has your daughter, has her condition been there since birth?
Yes, yes. Okay. Tara has cerebral palsy, it's there basically since 2 days after birth where she stops breathing. So her condition has basically, she has probably never physically, you know, graduated beyond being cared for like a young person, really. But like her mind is active and she knows what she wants. So,
but in terms of dependency, she's quadriplegic. She can't eat on her own. She needs constant care. Is she in pain?
She is often quite uncomfortable. She has a lot of spasm. She bites her mouth because of the spasm. Yeah. She can't eat because of that. You know, she does have a tough old time. She's a warrior.
Yeah.
You know, she is, and so just because, as I say, you know, I just wanted to highlight that side of things. Really, that people. I'll just give you one more sentence because I know you probably have a queue of people, you know, she is living here with us, and the policies at the moment are all about community living, living in your home, living in your community. Yeah. But we are not supported to do that, you know, by the state, in that, you know, there is no one to come in if we need to go somewhere. We have to, you know, she has to come with us really anywhere we.
And as I say, the maximum you will get on the means to, might change nominally, marginally in the last few days, but it hasn't come in yet. But the maximum you will get on the means test of carers allowance for the work you do is, what, €250, if you get it. But as Patricia's pointing out, 40 years, her wonderful, wonderful daughter has been cared for, and they wouldn't do anything else. Tara's been cared for, and they managed to get 1 year of carer's allowance for 1/40th of that time. Trace, stay with us, Patricia. Tracy McGuinness is in Wexford. Tracy, now, unfortunately, your son passed away, Tracy.
He did 2 years ago, yeah.
And you're listening to these horrific stories. Unbelievable, almost.
Well, all too
familiar.
It's familiar for those of us that have, you know, lived that life of being a full-time carer, especially to somebody like my son Brendan was profoundly disabled. very medically fragile, intellectually disabled. And I was a lone parent.
Okay.
So, as I was saying to one of your researchers earlier, in regards to carers allowance, so if you get lone parents payment and carers allowance, you can only get half of one of those. You're not allowed to get both of them, even though you're still caring 24/7, literally. Like I was nursing level care. I mean, he had epilepsy, severe cerebral palsy, peg fed. He couldn't sit. He couldn't walk or talk, hold anything in his hands. I mean, he was complex care. Put it this way, whenever he was in hospital, they required two nurses to perform his care. So, and of course, a lone parent is always a lone parent. So you get either half of the lone parent or you get half the carer's allowance, whichever you choose. Or you think one's, actually, they might be the same. But as far as how much they are weak. But again, the lack of fairness, just as it is with the means testing, for a couple, you know, when you have a partner, and if they make too much, then the person that is staying home doing that work, because it is work, doesn't get paid. And of course, to remember that it's saving the state billions a year in the unpaid caring work that happens in the home.
And remember, the maximum you would get if you are eligible for after the means test, the maximum you get is 250 to call it even.
Right, and remember during COVID, PUP, or what was that called?
PUP, the PUP payment.
The payment? That was 350 because that's what the state determined was the minimum to survive on. And I remember all of us carers were going, 350? Hey, we get 224 or what it was at that time 4 years ago, I think. You know, so
if you're lucky enough, if you can get through the means test. And Tracy,
when
did Brendan pass? When did he die?
He died. It's hard for me to think.
Okay.
He died in May 17th of 2022.
Oh,
he was 17 years old and 7 months. So.
And how have you coped since?
Not well, to be honest with you. The last couple years without him has been really hard. And it's odd. I actually found this year to be the hardest of the two.
What's going on there, Tracy?
I think it's just, you know, I think it's just a form. I write a blog. I've written a blog for the last 10 years about our life. And his birthday, or what his would have been his 20th birthday, was just on the 1st of October. So the last entry I wrote was not only about it being his 20th birthday, but about this year. And some of the decisions I've made, which in hindsight were not great, but I've kind of discovered that emotional breakdowns come in many forms, you know? And mine came in selling a house, moving away for 5.5 months with my younger son, and now coming back to Ireland after 5.5 months and saying, right, wow, I just kind of made a series of bad decisions, you know.
But you're back, Tracy.
I'm back. I'm struggling financially now, and my health is terrible. But, you know, my younger son is also on a scoliosis wait list to see a consultant. He's been on for 2 or 3 years now, and but he's back in his school here in County Wexford, and he's in fifth year, so
brilliant.
Back with his old friends, and he's just he's a godsend, my younger son. Yeah. He's amazing. And he was there when Brendan passed away in our house.
Yeah.
And he held one hand and I held the other. And yeah, it's...
And Tracy, where did you go for the 6 months?
We went to Norway. My grandmother was Norwegian. Okay. And I have family there, cousins there.
Norway?
Yeah, lovely country. But it's a fantastic country and I wish it would have worked, but...
And as soon after yourself and your other son got there, and you're grieving, obviously, it's totally understandable on your tree. You say you sold your house and you moved to Norway.
I did. And as soon after you arrived there.
And as soon after you arrived in Norway, did you realise, oh my God?
No, it was a few months after taking language lessons that it just wasn't sinking in with me as well as I needed. And I thought I would be able to get at least a part-time job speaking English until I was fluent in Norwegian. Discovered that just isn't the case, even though everybody there is fluent in English. They really won't hire you unless you speak fluent Norwegian, which is fine enough. You know, I'm not giving out about that, but I have long COVID, so my health isn't great. And part of it is I don't seem to be, my brain isn't receptive to like learning a totally new skill, like a language.
Yeah, but so, Tracy, got your heart on yourself.
I am. In my last blog piece, I said I'm my own worst critic, and I am.
Stop. I can't say stop to you, but look, you're so engaged. You're so, all of this sounds patronising, but you're so engaged. You've been through an awful lot. You loved, obviously, again, patronising Joe here, unfortunately, it might come across as. You love Brendan dearly, despite all his difficulties. You were deeply, deeply upset, yourself and your son, and you were with him when he passed.
I wish I could have him back, you know.
Yeah.
There's something about, well, he was my firstborn after a number of miscarriages, and I had him when I was 38, and to fight literally every day, to keep your child healthy and alive for almost 18 years. I mean, and it was a fight. I almost lost him a number of times over the years to pneumonia and things. Yeah. And then to actually watch them decline over about a month's time. And there was nothing I could do because his body stopped absorbing his PEG feeds.
Yeah.
So he literally starved to death.
Because of the way things were going.
Just wasted away. And, you know, of course there was hospice nurses that were helping guide me, and the GP and the pediatrician. And so I had all the medical support, you know, and consults and... But at the end of the day, you're alone in your house. Well, I had my other son. And all of that was left to me in those decisions. And you second guess, could I have done this differently or should I have? Or,
Where we are. You're settling back into Wexford, it sounds, with school and your son.
Great. Yeah, we are.
God rest Brendan.
Absolutely. He's with his fellow angels now. So
I suspect he knows. He knew how loved he was. But you didn't give me your other son's name. I don't know whether you want. He's
Declan on
one shoulder, and you on the other as he gently passed. May he rest. Tracy, look after yourself.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah. I appreciate, and a lot of people listening, I can see, appreciate you. Tracy, thank you so much. That's Tracy.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you. Bye-bye. joe@rt.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Marie is in Donegal. Marie, good afternoon.
Hello, Joe.
How are you? And good, thanks. And your daughter is 24 years of age.
Yes, and like yourself, Joe, she's one of triplets.
Oh, very good.
And I think I spoke to you years ago, anyway. Mm. But the point, it's not about, to me, I said to your character there, it's not about the money as such. It's about the fact that it's means tested.
Yeah.
You don't get means tested for children's allowance. You just get it.
Yeah.
And, you know, what do you call it? At the end of the day, you're a full-time call if you're a carer.
Yeah.
You know, you're not just, I can't go out and work and whatever, you know. So I'm at home all the time. And because, as I said, you're 30 there, because on paper, the other half earns maybe a bit more than what they should.
Yeah.
We don't get the carer's allowance.
And when you say what they should, what you mean is that they fall, it pushes you outside very limited. It's very limited means test.
It's exactly. So if you're any way over the money at all, you know, if you've got anything at all, then that you don't get it. And it's not about the money, Joe. It's just more the fact that it's kind of so cruel that, you know, if you're at home anyway looking after somebody, why does it matter what the other pair, not million, if they're millionaires, obviously you're not going to be you're not going to be looking for it, you know, that kind of way. So I just think it's a bit hard, you know, and I think sorry
I've
for other people.
Marie, just you've sparked something in me there. I've yet to hear of a court case where somebody was charged with pretending to be a carer.
Right.
And getting 100 quid or whatever a week. I've yet to hear it. I presume you've never heard of it. Why would anyone be disingenuous about that situation you're in? And which comes back to why are you, any other work that you go for, and the state recognises it, they recognise that work, but there's no other work that you do for the state. Do they say to you, oh, by the way, before we decide what your wages should be, your wages for the same work are going to be different to your next door neighbours for the same work because of what else is in the house. Totally irrelevant. Totally outrageous.
Totally irrelevant. That's my point, Joe. It's just, you know, and like, as I said, you're a circular, you can, I'm on full-time call. I don't mean that in a big self-pity way or nothing like that.
I know that.
But you know the way, if she goes to her, whatever, you know, and something happens, they ring me and I have to go and whatever. I say this is not a self-pity thing at all. Yeah. It's just making the point out there that people have to realise that just because, you know, you're in the house and you're looking after somebody, you're doing your best, but you are very restricted. Somebody said there, you know, it's a lonely place to be because you're kind of lose your own.
Yeah.
I don't know what the word is.
But someone said to me at the weekend, with the best of intentions and propelled by anger and compassion, said, why don't the carers march in the dock? I said, the carers are busy 24/7 every week of the year.
They don't want to complain. That's the thing. We don't want to sound like we say up here, nyamming. We don't want to sound like we're nyamming. But the point is that you are a full-time carer. And then they do this whole crack about, you know, means testing you, about giving you a couple of, what is it, 200 euros or something a week. It's not even about the money. It's just about the principle of the whole thing, that the carer doesn't have an option of going out to work or whatever, you know, that kind of way. Joe, that's all my point is, to be honest. Like, but anyway, that's it.
Okay, and your daughter is...
Thanks for your time. Your
trip. Thanks for asking for it. Your daughter is 24, so she's much younger than my 3, and please God, long life ahead.
Yeah, exactly. Your whole life. But anyway, it doesn't matter, Joseph. Happy days, anyway.
Well said. Thanks, you're great. Bye-bye, you're very kind. Bye-bye. Look at that. Look at that complete call in terms of somebody talking about her difficult situation, the way the state has been treating her and her child, and then to be to square it at the end and say, listen, you heard the tone of Mary there. Listen, there's other people with bigger problems than me, and I don't want to sound as if I'm yamming, as you said. She's not yamming. You weren't whinging. You were telling real life stories, and you're living it, Marie. You're living it. Joe@rte.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Kathleen, quickly come in. Calling Kathleen.
Hi, Joe.
How are you? You were at an ATM in the North City Centre of Dublin last Friday evening. We'll try and find this person near 6 o'clock. What happened, Kathleen?
That's right. I was just standing waiting just to get some cash out of the hole in the wall.
Yes.
And there was a man there who was just finishing up.
Okay.
And he left, and then I went to put in my card, but his money popped out.
Ah.
And so I just, and significant sum of money. So
okay.
We turned around, myself and my friend, to see if we could just see him. But we actually didn't know what he looked like because
okay.
this all happened very fast.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, maybe by the time we're finished, he'll come charging
back. Yes.
You know, for his money. Anyway, that didn't happen. I got my money and then we walked slowly down the street, keeping an eye out for any man that was tearing back looking for his money.
Yes.
But we didn't find him. We didn't see him.
And could you, well, so was the ATM in a bank or was it just in a wall? And
no, it was in the wall. It was in the wall. Yes.
So it doesn't go back in. The bank can't help.
So the bank couldn't help. So
and can you give us, Kathleen, a description of the running man?
I couldn't really, you see. I think he was.
Close your eyes for a second. Did he run fast?
No, he just turned, you see.
Yeah.
Just like as we were standing, like he turned. So we didn't see his face at all. I think he was wearing dark clothes.
Okay.
But I have no idea what he looks like. But he left
and which
a
direction?
Sum of money.
Okay. Did he?
But anyway, I want to get rid of this money. I want to give it to him.
But you still have it. You're very good.
And
no, so the person will know. We won't give out the exact location of the ATM machine, but
yeah,
it was last Friday, approaching 6 o'clock. It was in the city centre. We won't of Dublin. And did the man? So let me put it to you this way:
It all happened so fast, and he just disappeared. Well, as you do, like once you have, you know, your business done at the cash machine, you don't delay. So off he went. But we were so sure, like, he'd come charging back.
Okay.
But he didn't.
If someone phones in, I know what time it's 5 to 3. If someone phones in, one, you've told us the amount, and two, you've told us the exact location, and three, you've told us the exact time.
You'll be able to trace this man. I'm sure he has told friends of his what happened.
But all you were, the only thing you had to go on, Kathleen, oh God, you'd be a great witness. The only thing you had to go on was that you were waiting for a man to come back who in a state of panic.
In a state of panic, absolutely, yes. As you would expect, a man decided to take out a substantial sum of money,
so we
thought he'd be back very fast. Anyway, he didn't, so unfortunately. Anyway, I'm minding his money, and I'm hoping you're going to be able to help me find
him. Kathleen, you're very good. Kathleen, you're very good. You're very good.
There's lots of very good causes out there. I'll be delighted to help you.
Okay, you're very good.
If he doesn't come.
Okay, we'll put out the word. Okay, well done, Kathleen.
Okay.
A random act of kindness.
Joe.
Well done, being kind.
Thank you so much.
Where's Tom Kaplis before I finish? Thanks, Kathleen. Tom Kaplis. Tom, good afternoon. What happened to you, a random act of kindness? What happened?
My wife and I were on our way through Thomastown in County Kilkenny to a wedding ceremony.
Yes.
Driving down the main street, which was a one-way street, one of my tyres burst with an enormous bang.
Wow.
Startled people on the street, caused the car to swerve slightly and damaged the other tyre.
Oh.
I pulled around the corner, parked up the car,
Yes.
And a gentleman that I noticed on the street, who was startled by the loud noise, came walking up to me and said, "Looks like I really didn't know why he was coming, but he said, 'Looks like you're in trouble.'" I said, "That's an understatement. I definitely am. I have two tires damaged in the front of the car, and I'm on my way into the church to a wedding."
Yes.
So he said, "Look, give me the keys, and I will take care of it for you." Oh. So I thought about it for a second. I gave him the keys of the car. I thought he would change the tire. And when I came, sent me a text while I was at the wedding, came back out, two new tires on the car. So immediately I said, "Now, how am I going to pay for this? I had a card and limited cash." So I said, "Jimmy, what are we going to do?" He said, "No problem." He said, "How will I pay for the tires?" He said, "The bill for the tires is on the front seat of your car."
Mm-hmm.
I said, "And how am I going to pay you?" He said, "Consider it my good deed for the day."
Wow, what a dog.
So an extraordinary gesture.
And Jimmy, you know, Jimmy is his name. Thomastown Jimmy. Thomastown Jimmy.
Say again.
And if anyone knows, what do we know anything about Thomastown Jimmy?
Well,
what age group would he be?
Probably in his late 40s, early 50s.
Good man. And what does he do in real life, do you know?
I have no idea.
Okay. Apart from being does he wear a cape? Does he wear a cape, the Superman? So you want to say thanks to Thomastown Jimmy?
It doesn't have a logo, Joe. Yeah. The cape.
Sure. Okay. So, he's a good Samaritan, hero of the day.
He is a good Samaritan.
Okay. Where's thanks to the. I hope the wedding went well. Tom Kaplis. Anne Cumann. Anne. Another act of kindness. What happened?
Well, 2 weeks ago, was heading up in Spawell. You know,
in Dublin, Roundabout. Temple Hogan,
I was on the incline.
Yes.
And the car stopped.
Okay.
Not a place to stop, I guarantee you. Couldn't be a worse place to stop. And I'm not elderly, I'm old. Well, I'm old in years, but I'm not old, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting there.
Yes.
I didn't know what way to turn.
Okay.
And a young man appeared at my window.
Yes.
Told me to get out. He tried it. I couldn't get it into gear. Another man came in to help him.
Yeah.
The two of them got me to one side. Started to push it up the incline. I thought they were going to be killed because
were they pushing you up the incline, Anne, or the car?
No, I was pushing. I was asking nicely to stand up to one side. Don't you start around now. I'm telling you a nice story about kind people and listening to all the kind people.
So did they get your car started? Did they get
car?
Okay.
No, they couldn't start it, and they had to push it
in off the road. Well,
and I thought, God, help them, that'll roll back.
Yeah.
A third man appeared.
Wow.
The third man said he'd help, and then he helped him a bit, and then he said, "Listen, I'm going for an interview, I'll have to go."
Okay.
The man was going for an interview, and he got out of his car to help two men, help an old woman. Now, if that's not...
It's brilliant.
And I think it's time we in Ireland just pop ourselves on how fantastic we are. Kind we are. And our immigrants, the kindness of them. I've had a horrific year, the saddest year of my life. And the kindness every day is just overwhelming.
Okay.
And it's getting me through.
Well said.
So I just wanted to highlight that.
Well said.
And I tell you what, I even wonder. I mean, I don't leave this house any day that somebody, it's amazing, from behind me. Are you okay there, love? Can I give you with that? It's
great.
In Talla Hospital, in the middle of the night, a black lady who was on duty put her arms around me and saved my life.
Yeah.
You know, it's oozing out of us.
Well,
it's oozing
so,
into this country.
So,
we are fantastic.
And so well told,
Anne. Okay, thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Anne. That's Anne Cumann. So well.
Thank you, Joe. Up the Irish.
All of us.
All of them. They're all helping in our schools. They're helping in our hospitals. And we were kind to them. We were so kind to people in this country that took in immigrants to their homes. I mean, I was amazed at that. You know,
so eloquently and beautifully told, Anne. You're a beautiful person, to put it that way, and to be so grateful. Thanks indeed. That's Anne Cumann. On sound, Mark McGrath, research, Richie Byrne, producer, Shanna Gorman, Ray Darcy's next.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Discover our new autumn collection with fresh designs and cosy colours. In store or at harrycurry.com.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815 or send your WhatsApp voice notes to 087 484 8888.